Hello and welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy. I'm Chris North, and what you're about to listen to was originally broadcast as part of Pythagoras' Trousers, a science and engineering show on Radio Cardiff. You can find a full show and listen to past episodes at pythagorastrousers.co.uk. But for now, here's this month's astronomy. To start this month, I want to talk about exploding stars way across the cosmos, supernovae. In particular, Type 1a supernovae, which is the names given to explosions of something called a white dwarf, the final stage of a star like the Sun. Now, these Type 1a supernovae are very useful for measuring distances across the cosmos. They're standardizable candles. We can tell how fast they get brighter and then fade away, and from measuring that, calculate their distance. And that gives us measures of distance across to billions of light years away across the cosmos, and has led us to understand the expansion of the universe is accelerating, and the evidence for dark energy and so on. So these are incredibly useful objects to observe and incredibly important to understand. There have been two results out in May about what causes them to take place. I'm joined by Edward Gomez again from Las Cumbres Observatory. So welcome, Edward.
Hello, Chris.
So these two latest results have shown that there are the two possible ways of causing this particular kind of explosion.
Yes, yeah, so there are various different types of supernova explosion. Type 1a involves two stars. Type 2 supernovae involves one star. So that we call that a core collapse supernova, type 2. But this type 1a supernovae, it only ever happens when you've got a pair of stars, and the stars are usually orbiting each other, and usually you have a special star, a white dwarf star, which, as you said, is the remains of a star like the Sun, and something more like the Sun, so something that's gone through its whole life and formed a white dwarf, and something which is still living. And the thing which is like a zombie star, this white dwarf, is leaching material off, by material I mean gas, off its companion, and eventually that causes it to violate the laws of physics and it explodes. And because there's a limit to how much mass that white dwarf can take on before it violates the laws of physics and explodes, that provides us with a limit. And that's why we can use it as this standard candle, this way of knowing how bright this thing could be, because it can't take on any more material.
So we think these always happen when they get to almost 1.5 times the mass of the Sun. That's the limit. So they
that's right,
enough material,
yeah.
And they get to that point and then go bang.
Yeah, and that's called the Chandrasekhar limit. But we've suspected for a long time that they're not exactly what they pretend to be, or that people have thought that they are. They're not quite these standard candles, because you can get, well, for example, what happens if you've got two stars which are both white dwarfs? Then if they both start ripping each other's gas off each other, or one of them takes over and takes all the gas, or they merge, then you get two things which have a maximum upper limit of 1.5 times the mass of the Sun combining. So then you've got something which is, you know, obviously going to be a lot more massive and a lot brighter when it explodes. And so that idea, this is called a super Chandrasekhar white dwarf supernova, has put into doubt all sorts of things about how we, not only about this, the physics of this, but how we measure distance in the universe, because people relied on these an awful lot.
And one of the problems with observing these is that we see a flash occur in a distant galaxy, tens, hundreds, or thousands of millions of light years away even. And telescopes observe what looks like a new object to brighten, can be as bright as the entire galaxy it's within, and then gradually fade over time. That's all we see, one thing that lights up and decays. And actually seeing what caused the white dwarf is incredibly difficult, not least because they're so far away.
Yeah, that's right. And you've really no idea what the state was before. You can't run the clock backwards. And so you have to piece together from essentially the light that you've got after you notice this new thing, which might not be the instant that it exploded. It could be, you know, a few hours, a few days afterwards. So for astronomers, it's really important to jump on your local friendly telescope in a variety of different types of light, like the light we see with our eyes, but also ultraviolet and X-ray light, and try and look at this star and follow its brightness as it changes, and hopefully you see it continue to brighten, and then continue, and then after it's reached a peak, it fades away. So the part of this recent research was looking for these things, these progenitors, what the stars looked like before they exploded. And by not only looking at the optical light, the light that we see with our eyes, but looking at different types of light. And that's what led people to believe that in this case, there were two rather exciting objects that collided and exploded.
So we've seen some two objects that seem to be two white dwarfs combining, the situation you describe where you possibly get this super Chandrasekhar limit, but then also some observed which look like it was one white dwarf with its companion star, and there's actually a bright flash of ultraviolet light that you get when that shockwave from the explosion hits that companion star and heats up all the material within it. So that's been seen as well, and this is because of, you mentioned it's important to jump on these local telescopes, that we have two types of observations that really help with that. One is telescopes that look for things changing in the sky, and the other is telescopes that can react very, very quickly, either from the ground or in space.
Yeah, that's right. And that's something that Las Cumbres Observatory, the institute I work for, is ideally set up for. Because we have these robotic telescopes, we're not in the survey mode where you're looking for things that change, but we are in the response to those surveys. So we don't need somebody to go up to an observatory. All our telescopes are robotic and they're all over the world. And so this is the type of thing that we do, following up these type of observations. We actually have researchers in California who are working with a group who looks for these transients, a so-called Palomar Transient Factory. And this was one of the groups that was responsible for the discoveries that we're talking about.
And there's another group using the Kepler spacecraft, which is designed to look for extrasolar planets, the signature of planets going around other stars. But it was also looking at lots of distant galaxies and seeing these flashes of lights appeared. And this is going to change in coming years. We've got things being built, the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, which is going to be mapping the entire sky every few days. This is going to change the way astronomy is done in some ways.
Yeah, that's right. And there's, for a while, we've had Pan-STARRS and other of these big survey telescopes. Prior to Pan-STARRS and this Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, or LSST, the telescopes tended to be for a particular type of thing. But having a survey where you just look for anything that's changed, survey the whole sky regularly, every couple of nights, the whole sky every couple of nights, you know, down to a certain brightness and at a certain resolution, is quite an amazing feat in itself. And then look for things that have changed, you know, every time it goes through the survey. And this is the type of thing, exoplanets, asteroids, supernovae are exactly the type of thing that these big survey telescopes are looking for.
Now, you mentioned asteroids. This brings us back into the solar system, into familiar territory, perhaps. The probe of the moment, I suppose, is probably Rosetta, orbiting Comet 67P. And it released last year, its Philae lander, which bounced across the surface a few times. We spoke about it on this program, in fact. And it bounced across the surface before settling in a crevice, and its solar panels weren't connecting enough power for it to survive, for it to stay awake for long. But there's hope that it will turn on at some point in the future.
Well, actually, yeah, it might already be turned on, which is part of the infuriating things about when you send things up into space, is that you're limited by size and you're limited by the mass that you can send up. And Philae is very, very small, very compact, but it doesn't have particularly large solar cells, things that collect power, which is going to power this thing. So in order to send back signals from Philae to Rosetta, which is how we'd know whether Philae was awake, would take, I think it's 19 watts. Mm. So we could have the situation that Philae is awake and doing science, but just can't send the results back, which is incredibly frustrating. But there is a hope that as it's going past the sun, that it gets a little bit more light, and then it may be able to communicate with Rosetta in the future, and it just carries on with its mission.
And if in fact it is already awake, then they've been every time that the radio telescopes on Earth have passed by Rosetta and been able to send signals, they've sent the commands to Philae in the hope that it's listening, and if it is awake but just can't transmit, will start doing some signs. So there is a chance it's not only awake but also working and doing the stuff it's meant to do.
Yeah, that's right.
I know there's a bunch of papers coming out in the near future about the results from Rosetta and Philae, so that's going to be very exciting to see all the things that have been done from that its brief excursion across the comet's surface, which the images coming out of Rosetta as well are absolutely stunning.
They are, yeah, and it's definitely worth noting that this is a two-part mission. There's the lander and the orbiting satellite, and there's still a huge amount of instruments and science that can be done with just the orbiter, just the Rosetta part of the mission. So there's continuously, you know, Rosetta is still working, it's still going around the comet. Getting to the comet itself was a huge enough feat, and I think really the icing on the cake was landing something on it, which, you know, we successfully did. Watch this space for more very interesting stuff that is coming out of Rosetta that hopefully we'll be able to talk about in another podcast.
Yeah. Other probes in the solar system that are currently on their missions. We've got the Dawn probe, which is currently lowering its orbit around Ceres. This takes quite a long time for it to get down into its orbit. It's slowed down enough to be captured by the gravity, but it's taking a long time to lower its orbit. And that's because of the type of propulsion it uses. It doesn't have rocket engines on board like you think a space probe's having. It's got this ion drive.
Yeah, that's right. And again, this is because sending stuff into space is very expensive, and so you try to cut corners wherever you can. So this ion drive is just an electric thrusters. So these ion drives aren't particularly powerful, but they're very, very efficient. That's why you will eventually get to your destination. It'll just take a bit longer, so you know, you just have to be patient with these things.
Yeah, and all it needs, as you say, is just a little bit of xenon, I think they tend to use, and fire that out the back at particles go at very high speed, which is what gives it the thrust. One of the things Dawn's seen as it's approached Ceres is it's seen some white spots on its surface. So they're probably not, well, when I say white, they appear white in the images, but it probably just means they're very, very reflective. Now, that can mean that they're very young. They haven't been dirtied by dust and so on that have fallen back onto the surface. But the origin of these is a complete mystery to the Dawn scientists, and so much of a mystery that we can go and vote for them.
Yeah, that's quite nice to be able to decide whether you think it's a volcano or a crater impact or a variety of other things.
UFO, maybe. You
know? Yeah, that's right, yeah.
New technologies are being developed for this all the time. In fact, earlier this month, we had the launch of LightSail, or a prototype of LightSail, which the Planetary Society have launched to try and look at whether solar sails can work.
They've actually been around in science fiction for a long, long time. I think, in fact, the only time I can think about solar sail being used in a film was in one of the Star Wars films, that one of the ships had a big solar sail. But the principle behind it is just that light, because light is a wave and a particle, it can be seen as having a momentum. And if you give something momentum, you can push it. So momentum is mass and velocity. So velocity is speed with a direction. So if you've got light, which has this momentum, and you can transfer this momentum to something else, you give it a speed and a direction. And that's the essentials of a solar sail. You just have a big area to collect light, because the momentum that light has is very, very small. So you need a big, big collecting area. This is what this light sail is going to do. It was actually sent up flat-packed, a little bit like an IKEA wardrobe, it's going to assemble in space. I think they'll probably just very slightly spin the thing that the sail's attached to. It's attached to a CubeSat, which is a very small satellite, and when the rocket is sent up and the payload is opened up, the CubeSat will spin very slightly, and that'll unfurl the light sail. Now, this is just a prototype, as you said, and that means that it won't last very long. It won't go very far. It's really just to show that you could, you know, get some movement from this. In fact, I think it's probably only going to survive for a few days in orbit, because it's not very far away from the Earth, so it's going to fall back down and burn up in the Earth's atmosphere very, very quickly.
And a large surface area as well means a lot of drag from the atmosphere, which will bring it down even sooner, of course.
Yeah, that's right. One of the interesting things about this, so this light cell was sent up on an Atlas V rocket, and on board that same Atlas V in the payload was a super secret US government space plane. And it's the fourth time that space planes have been launched by the US government. And these have a variety of different applications. They could be, you know, the next replacement for the space shuttle. They could just be like high altitude planes, so that you could travel around the world in a few minutes instead of 24 hours. Various different things. So it's very, very exploratory. This also has an ion drive on board, which it is being used for propulsion. And again, this is not something which is very high power. It's 5 kilowatts, so it's the same power as a kettle. But because there have been three missions before this, the US government is very pleased with how this ion drive has been performing. So the company that made them is now going to build one which is 100 kilowatts, which is, you know, 20 times more powerful and will have 20 times, well, could even have more than 20 times the thrust, which is something that's very significant. So really, that's the way to go if you want to build, you know, a space plane.
And although ion drives aren't a good way of getting into orbit, they're too low thrust to actually get off the surface. As you mentioned, what Dawn's found with getting to asteroids, and other missions have used it in the past, but even within Earth orbit, you can use them to maintain your orbit. You just need a slight thrust, a slight push, just to keep you from dropping down into the atmosphere and falling back to Earth. So they're very useful for that kind of purpose as well.
Yeah, that's right. Once you're outside of the Earth's atmosphere, really all you need is acceleration. You don't really need to, there's nothing impeding you, so you don't need to maintain a velocity, unlike when you've got the drag of the Earth's atmosphere and gravity.
So very useful technologies being developed. So there's a lot going on. We've, of course, got New Horizons approaching Pluto. It's just released images of all 5 of Pluto's moons that it's now seen. So as it gets closer the next couple of months, we'll have to see what else it finds, and hopefully nothing directly in its path, I suppose.
That's one of the wonderful things about these space missions, is being able to see things like Pluto's moons. You know, Pluto wasn't discovered until the early part of the 20th century. It was much later than the rest of the planets because it's so distant and so faint. And really, you know, it's not a planet. In however you define a planet, it's not a planet. And having these moons that are going around it really, to me, proves that the International Astronomical Union was right to demote Pluto. But just, you know, this little microcosm out in the far reaches of the solar system, to be able to investigate that more and to find out more about these weird objects that are solid but at the edges of the solar system, quite unlike the four major planets that are there, is very interesting.
So that's a nice roundup of what's going on in the solar system and beyond. So Edward Gomez, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. It was originally broadcast on Radio Cardiff as part of Pythagoras's Trousers.